This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. 75 years after the conclusion of the 82-day Battle of Okinawa, we are reliving through the memories of men who were there, things that were unfolding at this very time in 1945. We're going to hear what a teenage Marine named Dale Anderson experienced there, but first a little background on how he ended up in the Marines. It wasn't exactly what he had planned when he and two friends went to join the military together.
The last thing my father told me, said, "Son, whatever you do, don't let them put you in the Marine Corps." He had been in the Army in World War I in the cavalry, and he knew the Marines were a dangerous part to be in, so he advised me that. But anyway, I argued with the Marine recruiter for about 30 minutes, and he said, "Well, I got to leave for a little bit. Think it over." So I thought it over, and I knew he was going to put me in the Marines whether I wanted to or not. So when he came back, I said, "All right, I'll go." So they put me in the Marines, they put Art in the Army, and Jack Taylor put him in the Navy. So they really split us up there.
So much for the best laid plans there. So you're in the Marines now. I guess they had to whip you into shape. Was that a tough job for you, or were you already in pretty good shape from all that work you'd been doing?
Well, I was in good shape, but it was still Marine Corps boot camp at San Diego was so hard for me because I was only 5'4", weighed 140 pounds, and here I was in there with 6'4", 6'5" guys. And when you're marching, trying to keep up with guys that's got that long of legs, I almost had to run all the time. And it was really hard. We were right next to the air base down at San Diego there. And we had one sergeant. His name was Sergeant Learn. He talked like he gave his commands like he had a mouthful of hot mush. He was hard to understand. And with the wind blowing, I caught one time I didn't hear his command, and I marched right up to the fence, joining the Air Force down there with the Marine base. And I was standing there marking time, afraid to look around because they had these what they call swagger sticks. And we had the old pith helmets, and they'd come down over your head with a swagger stick and that pith helmet on. It sounded like a bomb went off on your head. But I finally, after 2 or 3 minutes, I finally got brave enough to kind of look around. And there the platoon was all down about 50 feet behind me, waiting on me. And so when I got back in ranks, he said, "Flynn, take that man's name. He'll do extra duty this afternoon." And so boot camp was really, really hard. I remember one time we went to Chow, and of course they run a lot of men through there for breakfast. I had a frog in my throat, so I kind of got it up and spit on the pavement. The sergeant saw me, so that afternoon we went out where it was sandy, and he sat the platoon down and said, "Anderson, take your little shovel that you have and start digging." So I dug down to where I could just barely look out over the top of it, and he said, "Now spit in it." And of course, my mouth was so dry I couldn't spit, but I made the motion. And he said, "Now cover it up." And he said, "Now let that be a lesson to you and all the rest of you men that if every man came down for breakfast here, spit on the pavement, nobody'd be able to stand up." And so that was one of the hard things. And every day they'd march us around and tell us what all we could be shot for. And it's amazing what you can be shot for when you're in Marine Corps boot camp.
Sounds like they put the fear of God in you.
Oh, they did. They did. It was really hard. But I'm really proud to be a Marine because, like I told, I was teaching Sunday school class one day up at Dunlap Baptist Church. I said, "Marine Corps boot camp helps me every day of my life." I said, "You don't see any hair on my bar of soap." Because when they had inspection, if they picked up your bar of soap and saw a hair on it, you probably scrubbed the toilet with your toothbrush that afternoon. And so I heard a little chuckle in the back of the room, and I said, what's that? And some lady says, "You don't see much on your head either." We were in the 62nd replacement draft when we went over, and they were needing we heard later that 9 out of 10 of us that were going over in those replacement drafts were being killed at the time. But they left us on Guam for about 30 days, and then we headed on toward Okinawa.
Now, before we get to Okinawa, you mentioned 9 out of 10 being killed, and at this point, I mean, you're in the Marine Corps, and I'm sure you've heard about what's happened to the Marines at places like Tarawa or Guam or Iwo Jima, even more close to what was happening then. Was that intimidating? Did that cause some fear in you, knowing what could happen to you?
Yes, it caused fear, but it kind of also gave us more determination to go get the job done.
All that price that had already been paid in this war, that it wouldn't be worth anything if you guys didn't finish the job? Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's right. That's what we were thinking, yes.
So what did you know about this place called Okinawa?
Not a thing. Not a thing, except that it was really well fortified. We had heard that, but we didn't know much about a day out of before we got to Okinawa, a kamikaze plane came at our ship. The Navy and the Marines always kind of jaw against back and forth against one another, but I always really liked to hand it to the Navy boys because they were able to shoot that kamikaze plane out of the air, and it landed about a block from our ship. Otherwise, probably I wouldn't be telling this story.
And by this time, the kamikaze phenomenon had been practiced for a while by the Japanese, so you guys knew what that plane's intent was. Did you actually see it heading for the ship?
Oh, yes, we sure did. I sure did. Yes, I saw it heading for the ship. And that was a pretty scary moment for us. But we were so rejoicing, and a cheer went up through the whole ship when they were able to shoot it down so it didn't get our plane. It landed in the ocean and then blew up as it landed. So I was really thankful for that.
And that's a lot closer call than most of us can relate when it comes to military experiences. But you were in for some more close calls once you hit land there at Okinawa. Tell us about coming onto that island and what you encountered.
The northern half of the island was secured, and we landed toward the southern half of the island. Naha City was one of the big cities that was there close. As we came in the LST boats, he didn't get quite far enough in the shore, I guess because of the coral reef. But anyway, as I stepped off of the edge of the boat, of course I had my pack and my weapon, and I sank all the way under. I could not touch the ground, and had it not been for a couple of big 6'4" guys catching me under each arm and taking me in about 20 feet before I could even touch the ground, I'd have probably died right out there before I even got into battle. But we didn't take any fire as we were going in on the beach. But they loaded us in trucks and started taking us inland because the battle was raging inland. As we just kind of started out down this dirt road, kind of going uphill, I looked over the side and I saw just a half of a body laying in the trench, from the rib cage up. And we had a sergeant with us, Sergeant Ferguson, that had been over there before. This was his second tour. And I said, "Sarge, I just saw a piece of a body laying there." And he said, "You're going to see a lot of those from here on in." And he was right. Before we went in another probably mile, it was just getting dusk, and there must have been at least 20 of those half of bodies. It seemed like that the Japanese, when they were knew they were going to be captured, they would blow themselves up, and that was because of those bodies laying along there. And they took us in that night, and they bedded us down under about 8 or 10 10-inch guns, big guns, booming all night long. And they bedded us down under there, and they said, "You don't move from here tonight. If you got to go to the bathroom, just roll over and go. But if you get out of your sacks, you're liable to get shot before morning." And so we stayed close. We didn't get much sleep, but that was when we went in on Okinawa there.
And shot not by the Japanese, but by your own guys, thinking maybe you were Japanese coming into your camp. So you're 18 years old. You're on this island halfway across the world from where you grew up, and you've seen pieces of bodies everywhere. You're hearing these booming guns. What are you thinking that night as you try to get some sleep?
I was thinking, I sure hoped we had good guards that was standing guard duty, because every once in a while you'd hear of a guard going to sleep. So I couldn't really sleep soundly, and I still don't, because I was always afraid that a guard might go to sleep and instead of standing his post.
So that was the first night. You've seen some of the effects of this battle, of this war that cost so many lives worldwide, but you haven't experienced it all firsthand just yet. I imagine you didn't have to wait very long.
No. I think the next night or two, as we marched on in from there, one night, in fact, that's what I got the sword here from the souvenir. We were in our foxholes, and we had heard that the Japanese were going to make a banzai attack on our unit. We thought we were ready, but just about dawn, we heard them making a lot of noise. They were getting all doped up and everything. They tell us that they got, I don't know what kind of dope they used, but they got dope where they couldn't feel much pain. But they came at us with their swords hollering, "Banzai, Banzai." And, of course, we were started firing at them. And I wasn't aiming. I was just firing from the hip at this one big the Japanese were big on Okinawa. They were big Marines. But anyway, I kept firing. I thought somebody had maybe given me blanks for my weapon because he wasn't falling like he should have, but finally he fell right at the edge of my foxhole, and I got his sword here laying on the table. But that was a scary time. We did repel the whole Japanese unit there, kill most of them, but they were pushed back.
How difficult was that to go through that experience as a teenager?
It was very difficult back then, but it brings back it brings back tears to my eyes now because when I think about it and think how close I come to getting my head lopped off there, and some of the other guys that got killed, none of them got their heads taken off, but some of them were killed with the swords. But it is difficult, but it's so important that we pass this history on, so hopefully we never have another war like we had back then, or any war, for that matter of fact. History is so important to our younger generation.
If you can, put yourself in your mind then as an 18-year-old, how did you get beyond that the next day? Because that's enough to weigh someone down and really cripple them with just the weight of what was happening there. What do you think it was that helped you get through it and get on to another day?
Well, looking back on it, I think it was God that was directing and guiding this, even though I didn't know Christ at the time, but he brought me through it. But it was hard. I remember one morning we were going to chow. The mess hall was up on the hill. The island was almost secured at the time. I was passing by this small two-man tent, and I heard this explosion. One of my good buddies came crawling out on his hands and knees out of the tent, and there was a stream of blood about the size of your index finger shooting out his right temple. Every time his heart would beat, it would just psh. And, of course, he died there in just a matter of seconds. And the other fella named Gil Belcher, he was about 6'6" tall, and he came out of the tent all bent over, but he was running and screaming. And he just ran in a big circle out, and the guys had to catch him to hold him down. I thought that they had been playing with a landmine, and it went off. But that's not the case. One of them was cleaning his rifle, and as he pushed down to putting his rifle back together, he pushed down on a landmine, and that's what exploded. And he had like 170 pieces of shrapnel. He lived, but he got to come home, but he lived through it. But I didn't go on to breakfast. It made me sick at my stomach when I saw that blood pouring out of his head there. So it just spoiled my appetite that day.
What our veterans endured then and what our men and women in uniform sometimes face today, we should never take for granted. It's break time again, but when we come back, the special reminder that teenage Marine Dale Anderson brought home with him from Okinawa after a tragic situation that was unfolding 75 years ago this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.